Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hope everybody's doing well today and that your New Year's getting off to a good start. The theme of today's show is small-scale agriculture. How healthy is it? And we're going to feature an interview with Scott Marlow of RAFI, where we'll be discussing this issue. And I wanted to cover this topic early enough in the year so that people had time to think about some of the issues we're going to be discussing, especially you farmers and ranchers and producers out there, to start thinking about some of the issues we're going to be bringing up as it applies to your farm viability, as it applies to your farming operations, as well as your familial relationships and your health. I was going to start this show off by talking about a couple articles I had found on the rise of farm bankruptcies. And I changed my mind because of a couple of things happened. The first thing that happened was Gwendolyn was posting some eggs on Facebook, and in a group, Facebook page for a farmer's market that she attends. And she put the eggs up, put the price, which is $6, and started taking orders. And someone made a post about $6 an egg, someone lost their mind, or someone's crazy, or something along those lines, and Gwendolyn had showed me the post. And, you know, no, we don't really care when people complain about our prices. We know what we need to make in order to keep our farm viable, to make sure that our operations pay for themselves. And, you know, we just rather see those people walk away rather than put our farm in jeopardy or work ourselves to death for nothing. But anyway, for some reason, this woman's comment just really got to me. I don't know if it's because I've been reading a lot of stuff on farm bankruptcies and farmer stresses in order to prepare for this show. I just don't know what it is. And I have been really, really good about disciplining myself about getting into Facebook brawls. And, you know, but that ticked me off. You know, farmers and teachers are the two groups of people in this country where people basically expect you to work for nothing. And that just bugged me. So I replied to the woman and nicely at first explained to her what feed cost, what it cost to maintain the chickens, what it keeps our chickens healthy, how much labor we had to put into it. And we can't afford to sell our eggs at 99 cents a dozen. And then I further pointed out to her that those 99 cent eggs you see at Dollar General or CVS or the local supermarket, they have a dark side to them too, which we're going to get into one day. But there's some downsides to those 99 cent eggs, and there's some costs that society pays for those 99 cent eggs that people don't realize. And then she said something back, and I said something back, and it got kind of ugly and nasty. So I apologized to the market manager, told her to, you know, that lady just got on my nerve, delete the post, and I apologized, and she did. And she said, she told Gwendolyn to tell me don't feed the trolls. But that's what the theme of the show is going to be about, it's going to be today, is how healthy are these small farms? Are we really being realistic about the state of small-scale agriculture in this country? Or are we just painting a rosy picture behind which the wall is rotting? And we're going to be talking about that a lot today. The other thing that happened was I came across a couple of articles that I'm going to be sharing with you. One is from a farmer in Kentucky named Chris Newman, and he published it on a website called The Medium. I've never heard of them, but the name of the article is Small Family Farms Aren't the Answer. The romance of neoliberal peasant farming blinds us to our collective power. So overall, this guy's making the argument that the days of the standalone, independent, small-scale farmer are done, and that these farmers need to be organizing themselves into cooperatives in order to be successful. And he makes some interesting points in the article, which I'll go ahead and read to you. He talks about the benefits and how before the rise of our current food system, that everything was a collective. The old agrarian societies, everything was a collective. So he says, we in that cohort trade the benefits of agrarian collectivism, living wages, retirement, same workload, profitability, survivability, and a capacity to make a game-changing impact for rugged independence, complete autonomy and decision-making, and the ability to grow what, where, how we want, set our prices as we please, sell wherever we choose, and work ourselves into the ground. In short, we've done the most modern American thing possible, bartered away our quality of life for the freedom to be miserable. He goes on to say, and this guy's pretty tough on farmers markets, not to the point of saying just being tough to be tough, but he says, go to a big farmers market this weekend and have a look around. Each of those independent producers will tell you interesting stories. 80-plus hour work weeks, getting by without health insurance, paying employees next to nothing and or relying on volunteers, supplementing with outside jobs, enduring broken marriages, worn out bodies, social isolation, strained finances, emotional burnout. Is this true? Absolutely. I can just tell you from my personal experience, when we ran a CSA here, I think at our peak, it was about 70 members, which is pretty good for a little two-acre farm. At the same time, we were doing four farmers markets a week. We did a CSA. We spent a lot of time on the farm, and we went through a lot of stressful situations, and it got so one day I had an argument. I don't even remember what the argument was about. Gwen and I were working down the hill, and I had an argument with her, and she finally said, hey, look, I quit. You know, she picked up her little basket of tools and walked up the hill, sent her resume out the next day and got a job. But that is so true, and we don't talk about this stuff enough. You know, when I was managing Georgia Organic's farmer mentoring program, one of the biggest things people would ask me about was about not about their seeds, not about their fertilizers, not about which vegetables to grow. It was how to manage their work on the farm with the expectations of their spouses. And it got so that, you know, I asked George Organic, hey, this is a topic you guys really need to cover at your conference. And I think we did a panel one day. I'd like to see more of it being done. But absolutely, that's true. He goes on to say that the way that we're doing things now is not a long-term viable solution. He says it's categorically unsustainable, and extractive agricultural interests are counting on it. In particular, farmers being so preoccupied with non-farming tasks that we don't have the headspace to consider alternatives or act strategically. Ecological extractive agriculture drawing the kind of margins that attracts private investment and capital, while restorative agriculture does not. Our competition is relying on the inefficiency of our self-investment, such as farmers markets, which is driven by farmers internalizing the mythic virtue of rugged independence, which keeps us isolated and denies us the efficiency, effectiveness, and power of acting collectively to countermand the efficiency, effectiveness, and power of private capital. And now we know this. It's time to do things differently. And he's right. He is absolutely right. A lot of farmers have, you know, off-farm jobs. You know, we have an intern here now, an apprentice here now, who, for a variety of reasons during her first year with us, she just had to spend more time at her job in order to meet some of her living expenses and stuff like that. So we do need to do things differently. And I think one of the issues is that we're not asking the right questions. We're not digging down into the data to see what's actually going on in the ground. So that brings me to the next article I came up with this week. It was by a woman called Maggie Kurth, whose works were, I believe, 538, which is, many of you may know, is a really big polling firm. You'll see them all over the TV. You are seeing them right now all over the TV as we get closer to the election. But her article is entitled, Big Farms Are Getting Bigger and Most Small Farms Aren't Really Farms at All. So this is sort of a wonky article, and it starts out by saying if Kansas had an official state billboard, it might be a squat square sign featuring a cornucopia of a paper grocery bag and the words, "One Kansas farmer feeds 128 people plus you." First erected in 1978, these signs make a simple and direct point. Every farmer who works the land produces the meals of many non-farmers, which is why a lot of people were worried when in 1986, the government predicted that the number of farms in the U.S. was set to fall by half. Now, I wasn't really I was still in IT in 86, so I really wasn't following this stuff back then. But that prediction was made by the Office of Technology Assessment in a 1986 report on the changing state of agricultural technologies. There were 2.2 million farms in 1982, the OTA wrote. They were likely to be 1.2 million by the year 2000. The idea wasn't so much that food production would fall, those 128 people plus you would still be fed, but that who they were fed by was changing. Farms were industrializing, consolidating, and the mid-sized farms of the old McDonald farm and the Dell sort would be the losers. So as you'll see in my conversation with Scott, that has been happening, and it's been continuing at a rapid pace. This change in the agricultural landscape where we basically have very large farms on one side and very small farms on the other, an increasingly vanishing number of farms that's right in the middle. So some of the things that interesting things that they looked at was just what is a farm? And we have this conversation all the time, those of us who work in the space. What exactly is a farm? And they go right to the agricultural census, which defines farms as any place from which $1,000 or more of agricultural products were produced and sold, or normally would have been sold during the reference year. And they go on to say that if adjusted for inflation, that $1,000 a year threshold will probably be $5,000 today. But I've read this definition quite a few times and never really paid that much attention to the phrase, or normally would have been sold. So what they're going to put out is that you can actually have a farm that doesn't produce anything, but still gets counted as a farm. And because it would have normally produced something. Now, I don't know how they make that distinction or how they make that leap in logic, but apparently it's there. So what's that mean for us? A lot of agricultural programs are based on the number of agricultural funding from places like USDA, for example, are apportioned based on how many farms you have in your state or in your county. And the point that they make out is that everybody knows that the definition of farms needs to be changed, and some of this data really needs to be taken a hard look at, and we need to change some definitions of some things. But politics plays a role in it, the article says. The definition and any push to change it is up to Congress. For the farmers and their political supporters, there are probably benefits to the perception that there are a lot of small farms scattered across the country. The farm bill might be a bit harder to garner enough votes to be passed, since this would be far fewer small farms to be counted, and a perception that large farms don't need government support. There's a potential legislative downside to changing the definition and a potential bureaucratic upside to leaving it alone. So what I take from this is that big ag reaps the benefits of the public perception of small agriculture, but small ag, which does do small ag, does not. We don't get near the amount of funding from USDA that I think we should. And it's just troubling that this perception of small family farms has been co-opted by big industrial agriculture. I'll even further say that you rarely see depictions of black farmers or farmers of color anywhere. You know, it's very hard to see. Actually, in the articles that I'm reading, I think the copy that I have is black and white, but I think the author of the first article may be African-American. I'm going to go check. I'm also going to try and have him on the show. But, you know, to see that how the game is rigged against small-scale agriculture is very troubling, especially when the perception of what we do is being used to support people who typically don't believe in what we do. So that's what today's show is going to be about. I think it's something, one of the things I've seen over close to 20 years that I've been involved in this is that we in small-scale agriculture don't do a good job of baselining our existence. We don't collect enough technical data. We don't financial data, especially. I've been working with an organization that has really been trying to get some funding to baseline what successful farms look like over a long, you know, a 3 to 5 year period. You know, what are they doing that allows them to sustain themselves? And how are they doing? What are they doing? How much are they spending? Where are they selling? How much are they selling? How are they handling their labor cost? And it's been tough to get funding for that. But we need to do it. We need to do it. And I'm going to close this segment by asking a couple of questions leading into the interview with Scott. So the first one I'm going to ask is, does putting a farmer's market in a distressed community automatically guarantee, or does putting a farmer's market in an unhealthy community make that community healthier? Does it? Is urban agriculture a truly sustainable and financially viable long-term form of agriculture? I don't know the answer to both those questions because nobody's really, really bothered to do that much research on it. And that's what we're going to be talking about. The importance of data, how a lot of this data is used against us, and how it helps foment some of the policies in this country that make it very, very difficult for small-scale ag. Stay tuned for my interview with Scott. So welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. And my guest today is Scott Marlow with Raffi. And Scott and I have crossed paths many times. Scott, first of all, tell people what Raffi is.
Raffi is the Rural Advancement Foundation International, USA. We're a nonprofit based in Pittsboro, North Carolina. We work all the way from the very local, working with individual farmers on financial issues, technical assistance on new farm enterprises. We run a farm crisis hotline. People who are about to lose their farms come to us. But then work all the way up to the national and international policy levels. So do a lot of work. I'm the senior policy specialist here at Raffi. This is our whole office is here in Pittsboro. We've got about, 14 people here. And my work is heavily focused on financial infrastructure, access to credit, risk management, structure of risk management programs, disaster programs, and really taking the experience from the individual farmers that we work with, both on new enterprise development and on the financial crisis issues, and taking what lessons we can out of that experience into the policy realm and into education. So I do a lot of education for both farmers and farm advisors around access to credit, disaster, work on a lot of disaster programs and disasters, but then also into the policy realm, farm bill and regulations and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, me and you got a lot of talk about on this interview. Yes, this is a very interesting time for small family farms. And in preparing for this interview today, I get a news feed that talks about what's happening in ag and stuff. And as you well know, a lot of the news around agriculture is about farm bankruptcies. And so I've been getting a lot of these. And I pulled down an article that it was a NPR interview, I guess, with Executive Vice President of the American Farm Bureau. And they would just talk. First of all, one of the interesting things I found, and I just found this out recently from personal experience, I did not know there was such a thing as a Chapter 12 bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Which is specifically for farmers and
fishermen,
how they are increasing across the country. But it's very interesting in reading this article is that they specifically talked about the Midwest. But I read another article that talked about how these, and I think they specifically concentrated on Chapter 12 bankruptcies. And in terms of the percentages of bankruptcies, the Midwest was the lowest. I mean, the South was
at 70%. I'm going to try and look up this. The South was high. The Southwest and the West was higher than the Midwest. And it was just interesting how they're gauging this crisis solely. It just seems to me solely on one particular geographic region. Now, I know the Midwest has a lot of large farms. They have a large base of commodity farmers, but that just seemed troubling to me.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot of history around that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would say is we tend to talk about some of these things about periods of farm crisis. So we talk about we have the term about the 80s farm crisis, and people have used the term farm crisis now. What I would say is using that language is problematic, mm-hmm. because the process of consolidation of farms and moving to larger and larger and going after economies of scale and specialization and industrialization, that process has been going on for a very, very long time. That line has been moving for a very long time. And the moments that we talk about in terms of crisis are moments where that line and locations where that line just moved faster. Right. So it's not like after the 80s farm crisis was over, no more mid-scale farms were going out of business. It's not the case at all. It just wasn't at the kind of critical mass that was garnering attention. And so we're in another point. And a lot of this consolidation took place and was happening across administrations, it's a core piece of federal policy that economies of scale and industrialization is good. And so there are a huge percentage of our federal policies that facilitate that transition and facilitate basically running mid-scale family farms out of business in favor of much larger scale farms. Part of what you have in the Midwest is, and I mean, there are a lot of reasons, and we can speculate. I'm speculating on why that focus on the Midwest. Part of it is, the Midwest, these issues play out differently in different geographic areas and in different forms of agriculture. So, for instance, at times when grain prices, corn and soy prices might be low, that's actually a good time for livestock farmers who feed grain and corn because their costs are down, right? So, different parts of, we can talk about agriculture. We sometimes talk about agriculture as though it's monolithic, like it's all one thing. It's really not. It's very different. Different commodities, different scales, different geographic regions. There's more clarity in the Midwest because the Midwest is much more dominated by the large-scale grain crops, corn, soy. The 80s farm crisis was a very clear window of transition in the Midwest of consolidation, where some of those things weren't quite as clear in some of the other geographic regions. There were more complicating factors. There was a history of a lot of issues around discrimination and targeting playing out more specifically in other parts of the country. So there's been a pattern of focus on the Midwest because agriculture is a big part of that economy. And it's you can get a clearer picture because there's more, it's a more uniform, range of agriculture. I agree with you, though. We've never had a time on our crisis line when the phone was not ringing. We've never had a time in my time doing this. And for about 10 years, I was the point person on the hotline. That I was the person who answered the phone. We've never had a time where we weren't taking in cases, and sometimes more, sometimes less. It is challenging that a very large amount of the conversation around both farm transitions and a lot of other things is really dominated by the focus on Midwestern corn, soy, somewhat cattle and hogs, large scale, and that agriculture. And that Midwest tends to drive the train on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I completely agree with you. There are a lot of different places where this has played out over time. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different parts of agriculture that have gone through their own restructuring and their own crises, for want of a better term, separately from corn and soy.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I just think about Hurricane Michael, where Don Cooper, who does a lot of work around helping folks get some of these federal grants that are out there. But he got some statistics from the Georgia Department of Agriculture, And the numbers just blew your mind. You know, in Southwest Georgia, there's a lot of timber production. There's a lot of pecan production.
Yeah.
And the numbers just blew your mind. I think they lost $700 million or $800 million in timber. They lost probably an equivalent amount in pecan production. They lost poultry houses. And nobody ever talks about that. You know, you haven't heard of that. Actually, the big controversy, Don has a podcast. And he said one of the big controversies down there was that when the national media came down there to cover the hurricane, it was all about, the slant of the stories was all about, this is the chickens coming home to roost for conservative voters, you know?
Yeah.
You don't believe in climate change. So basically you're getting what you voted for. And what Don was trying, you know, there's a lot of black farmers down, you know, Shirley Sherrod's
sure.
down there.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And it's just amazing how we don't have these conversations about other parts of the country. And that leads me to something else I want to talk to you about. So you always give a talk. You're going to be at Southern SOG. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Carol Williams, the new executive director of Southern SOG. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be there talking about why farms fail. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on early as we head into 2020, because I think small family farms, more than ever, are under the gun. And
yeah.
I just want you to talk a little bit about what that talk is and what you think about how we're training farmers now and what's going on with small family farms.
So let me, there are a couple of things in that I want to make sure we cover.
Mm-hmm.
One is, as we talk about farm crisis and talk about the what like individual farm crisis and what farmers go through in this process, one of the main messages that we always put out is you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that we have to look at, you know, we had the Secretary of Agriculture say, you know, this is America where, you know, the big get bigger and the small go out, mm-hmm. right? Or something like that, you know, which is remnant of the old Earl Butts, fence row to fence row, get bigger, get out. So the first thing you have to say is, we tend to look at farm and part of the rural character for people who are farmers is that independence, my own bootstraps, my own hard work, you know, the importance of the individual, right? Determinant of my fate. That independence is playing out in a scenario where we have a policy and an economic system that is saying we want fewer, larger. And there are thousands of ways that that driver is happening. And when we have huge investment in the development of technology that requires covering more and more acres in order to make it pay out, when we have huge public investment in technology to allow larger and larger scale, you know, I constantly hear people bemoaning the concept of beginning farmers can't get in, all those kind of other things. Well, you know, when your whole system is predicated on fewer, larger farms, what do you expect's going to happen? Mm. You know, on a much higher barrier to entry, a much higher level of, you know, the one of the companies was signing up growers to put in poultry houses. The entry level investment was $1.5 million by the producer. $1.5 million. And I remember a farmer said to me a while ago, he said, you know, when I was a kid, when you turned 16, your parents gave you 10 hogs. And you grew them out, you sold them, and you bought 20. You grew them out, and you sold them, and you bought 30. You grew them out, and you sold them, and pretty soon you were farming, and you didn't have any debt. Mm-hmm. Now to get in, you're $1.5 million in debt
yeah.
to get in the door. Mm-hmm. And there's no place. If you sell, you know, if you grow those 30 hogs, there are very few places to sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing when we talk about the failure and those things is we have to recognize that folks, that these issues are playing out. You know, we can talk about these issues in terms of cash flow and access to markets and making sure, you know, tracking your net income and those kind of things, the internal issues around having a farm be a going concern, right? We can talk about it at that level. But, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about it in terms of farmers are increasingly playing against a stacked deck. Mm-hmm. They're playing a deck that is stacked against them. Mm-hmm. There are increasing number of, and the things that we see in our work with individual farmers who are in crisis. And this is not mine. It came from a different publication. In terms of what puts farmers under 5 D's, the 5 D's: disasters, divorces, deaths, disease or disability, and disagreements. Right? Those are things that put farms out. Right? Natural disasters, and a lot of what those things are about is farms are hanging in there, and they're not making a lot of money. They're making a little bit of money. They're hanging in there. And when something happens, there's very little, if we bring in here the concept of resilience, there's very little financial resilience. There are few reserves. There's very little financial resilience. And in a concentrating market, that's really true. People are struggling those margins are very, very narrow. And so when you have a natural disaster, now let's talk about natural disasters for a second. We've had a couple of those. We've mm-hmm. had some big ones. You were talking about
a few, actually.
We've had a few, right? And we're going to have more. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's I looked at it in the southern region. I looked at the maps. I think that there's a small part of western Tennessee, which is, I think, the only part of the entire southern region that has not been declared a disaster in the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Like there was a tiny little section of counties that had not had a disaster declaration. But the whole rest of the region has been declared the disaster in the last couple of years.
That's amazing. You
know? Our core production risk management and disaster program is crop insurance.
Yeah.
Insurance is predicated on actuarial tables. The greater the amount of data, the more you can define the risk and quantify the risk, the more cost effective that can become. Mm-hmm. And this has huge implications for sustainable agriculture, because what that means is that the crops that have a lot of data, large scale commodities, you know, we can say the price and yield of corn in any county in the country for the last 80 years. USDA can't say how much produce went through farmers' markets last year.
Yeah.
Right. We're not ever, ever going to have the data, which mm-hmm. means that the risk management programs for those large scale commodities are going to be easier to develop the programs. Mm-hmm. They're going to be more cost effective. They're going to be more readily available. It's economies of scale, so that the folks who are selling them, they're going to be able to sell them more easily with a greater return. When you move into, and the unit of analysis for crop insurance is a single crop in a single year. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that, let's bring in sustainable agriculture practices. Anything that manages risk across crops or across years. So across crops, that means crop diversification. That means spreading things out. Across years, that means the use of cover crops, conservation, which may increase risk in a single year, but is going to reduce risk over time. They don't get recognized in crop insurance. They're not incentivized, and they may be disincentivized, actually are disincentivized. So what that means is the way we have and develop disaster programs, the way we have the structure of crop insurance selects over time and rewards over time the farmers who will be most dependent on federal programs and on taxpayer dollars mm-hmm. over time. It selects for them. Mm-hmm. So basically what we are doing is, over time, increasing dependence on the government and dependence on government payments mm-hmm. by having a very large scale industrialized system that fails very poorly, has little resilience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? And this has huge implications for who gets to farm, how they get to farm, what they get to farm, and access to credit.
Like, yeah, so
we see access to credit really tied to crop insurance.
Yeah, this same NPR article talked about how, in response to the current tariff situation, how the bailout payments were really helping farmers. But when those tariffs were first announced, Scott, I had two thoughts. One was that there's going to be a bailout program, and two, that they were never going to make it down to small farmers. And they were especially not going to make it down to black farmers. You know, you can see the writing on the wall, and that seems to be why it is how it's playing out. But I had a chance to spend some time with the agency head of NASS, the National Agriculture Statistics Organization. And it was during, we had a chance to go up there. I was with Southern's Ag Leadership Program. And we had a chance to go up there and just tour their facilities, see how they gather, see how they do their lockdowns to do when they announce their crop reports and stuff like that. And it was during that I found out that they have, during the ag census, they actually were trying to capture some numbers on local food production and, mm-hmm. and that type of stuff. And I, first of all, I didn't know that. And B, so I went and took a look at the questions and, you know, it was amazing to me that they approached it from all the wrong directions. You know, they were asking folks to ask farmers about income and crop production. And you know how it is getting financial information out of farms. They're like, sure, teeth sometime. And I was like, well, you know, like you said, the deck is stacked because you're not even starting out from a good information collection point where you're asking the right questions. And it was just very frustrating. I'm going to complain to NASS about how they're collecting that information. But you and I have had this discussion about sustainable agriculture and about how we need to do a better job of justifying our existence and collecting the data that really shows what's important to us. And that's been a tough slog, you know, and I'd like to know your opinions about that.
I want to hit two things, two issues that you raised. One was this issue of the tariff payments. It's the market facilitation program payments. Mm-hmm. Those payments are coming out in two, what are called tranches. It's coming out in two tranches. The first one was based on production numbers. So a per acre, per hundred weight, per animal, you know, you get an extra amount that way. The second is based on acreage. So you get a certain amount for acres. So understanding what it's called the market facilitation program. The first issue that you raised was that's not getting down to small scale farmers and that's not getting down to black farmers. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about why. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is true, and it's just true, is the history of discrimination, of systemic and direct discrimination throughout USDA that is extremely well documented. I mean, there are multiple internal USDA studies that show differential impacts and differential, it's both in how programs were designed and how they were implemented, right? So it's systemic in multiple ways. So what that means is, and those differentials were heavily in issues of access to credit and access to large scale commodity programs. And that's just it's not that's not debatable. It's just true. So what that means is that the folks who would be subject of that discrimination would not have had access to the risk management in terms of commodities programs and also the credit programs to be able to grow and build into a larger scale operation that is able to be economically viable producing the commodities that these payments are associated with, right? The fact that what you're saying about this is not going to get to this set of farmers is very directly the result of that long-term discrimination and that long-term concentration. And it is predicated on, like I said, these two, the two payments that are part of the market facilitation program. One is based on production. So obviously the more you produce, the more money you get out of it. So if you're a smaller scale producer, you're producing less. The other is based on acreage. So the more acreage you have, the greater your payment is. The acreage payments range from $15 to $150 an acre, right? So if you're a 10 acre farmer and it's based on county, it's just your county has a number, you know, your county is $45 per acre or whatever. Well, if you're a 10 acre or a 20 acre farmer, obviously $45 per acre, it ain't that much money, right? If you're a 1,000 acre farmer, it's a lot more money, right? But we have to look at that structure in the context of that history. And So the other issue that you're raising is this issue of information collection. And what are we measuring? What are we looking at? What is really what you're getting at is what is agriculture? And I was meeting with the policy person from one of the agricultural banks. And I was talking about these dynamics around scale and dynamics around diversification and other things. And he looked at me and he said, cows and plows. And I said, excuse me? And he said, cows and plows. So what do you mean? He said, that's what agriculture is. It's cows and plows. It's cattle and large scale commodities. That's agriculture. That's what drives the train. The rest of it is irrelevant. It's a rounding error, right? It's not significant. And that's a long-term sort of framing, right? A focus in those ways. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we are working on quite a bit is this issue around information collection and who owns data. We're at a really important moment in terms of data collection, which is there is an astronaut. So in the early days of sustainable agriculture work, and you sort of remember this, there was very little research on it. There was very little testing on it. There was very little data collection. And to be honest, in ways a lot of it was based on people's individual experience and what they saw play out on their farms. So early advocacy around sustainable agriculture was around proof of concept, which means that it was individual stories. I remember early Southern SOG publications were stories, like here's stories about these farms and how they were able to do these things, right? So it was very story-based. It was very anecdotally based. It was, and it was very individual experience. I have had this experience, which is different from the analysis of the rest of agriculture, right? As we got into it and as sustainable agriculture grew, one of the challenges is, there was a much more of a call in Southern and SARE in general, and Southern SARE was one of the major proponents for more systems-based research. But that systems-based research was limited by a combination of access to data sets and access to computing analysis capacity. Like how big a multivariate analysis did you have the computing power to do? So there's a window of time where we had the concepts of the research, but not necessarily the data sets and the computing power to do it. Mm-hmm. What we have now is a fascinating situation where we're starting to actually have that. Mm-hmm. The question is who owns it and who controls it? Because for most of agricultural history, USDA data sets have been pretty definitive. And some companies have their own data and have their own research and all those kind of things. But USDA data was pretty definitive. And right now, USDA is getting left in the dust. Mm-hmm. Because you have astronomical amounts of information on that large-scale acreage and those large-scale farms. There's so much data coming off in the form of the GPS precision agriculture, the mm-hmm. GPS data that's coming off of the equipment mm-hmm. that's being uploaded into private company cloud. Mm-hmm. Right? It is owned and controlled by industry, mm-hmm. not public, not the university. So increasingly, in terms of that analysis, USDA and university data sets are irrelevant. Or not irrelevant, they're just way behind mm-hmm. and way smaller. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge issue right now playing out around who owns the information coming off of someone's tractor? Just like there's an issue around, I carry around a cell phone. We all do. Who mm-hmm. owns the data that's coming off of my cell phone? Mm-hmm. Right? Yes. Same thing is true for tractors and combines. Yeah. The concept that a company has access to real-time yield numbers coming off of a critical mass, a statistically significant portion of acreage in the Midwest in terms of grain markets is an incredibly significant issue. Mm-hmm. So I know that your question was around small scale and family mm-hmm. farms and that. Well, in terms of sustainability, there are some really core, critical issues around sustainability that are playing out in the commodity scale agriculture mm-hmm. world mm-hmm. around mm-hmm. who gets to decide, who owns the information, who gets to ask the questions. From working with SARE, and SARE's been such an incredibly important partner on a lot of these research pieces. Who gets to ask the question goes a long way to determining what the answer is. Yeah. What research gets done? Who gets to decide? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, this is data that not too long ago was owned by the farmer. It was either in a notebook or an Excel spreadsheet But, you know, I always tell people, I remember when you used to leave work, you left work. When you got off work, you got off work. And it just seems like technology is just increasingly being intrusive.
Yeah.
And the question is, as that technology digs into our farming operations, into our lives, how much of that do we own? You know, at what point do we say, this is my information and I'm not going to share it? So one of the things I want to talk to you about, Scott, is, you know, in sustainable ag, we see, like, going back to your point about stories, we see these amazing stories about small farmers and just, you know, how people are taking over vacant city lots and doing all this work around urban ag.
Sure.
And I don't want to say I've become jaded, but I think I've become, being, you know, as a small farmer myself, as a person who's been advocating for urban ag for quite some time, I don't want to say I've become jaded, but I think I've reached to the point where, you know, I need to read the tea leaves. And I don't think small farmers are doing as well as the stories would have us believe. You know, no one ever asks farmers, you know, you see these stories now about how farmers, how these small farmers are not making any money. And they're making $10,000 a year or grossing $10,000 or $12,000 a year. And they still need to take on off-farm jobs and to live up to the promise of, you know, becoming a viable and a sustainable supply of food. You know, we're going to have to ask some tough questions. And I just want to get your opinion about that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I've had... And I want to come at that from a couple of different directions. Mm-hmm. One is, so you mentioned before I do this talk called Why Farms Fail.
Mm-hmm.
What that came out of was an experience of being at a sustainable ag conference and sitting in, and at the time I was the point person on our crisis hotline, and sitting in on a beginning farmer workshop and sitting in the back of the room going, wow, if they listen to this advice, if they do this, they're going to be in my office in 4 years.
Mm.
Right? I'm like, I give them 4 years before work talk and restructuring, unless they come in with really significant family money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and one of the patterns that we see is a lot of folks who get into the smaller scale, you know, agriculture is getting, part of the challenge is that agriculture is getting very, very big and very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where we're losing the mid-scale. Where we have a rise in number of farmers is in the very large, 2,000 and above, and the very small, 10 and below, right? For those 10 and below, you know, I've had the experience of being at a sustainable ag conference and watching a farmer receive Farmer of the Year awards and being held up as an example and teaching and beginning farmer programs and knowing that literally the next day they were going to be in my office because they were broke.
Mm.
And no one's talking about that. Mm. And I've had that frustration. I've also seen folks, you know some of them too, I've also seen folks who made their entire living off of 2.5 acres for 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
There are some folks who can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard to do, and there are a lot who are not. I completely agree with you that we have to have some really hard conversations.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we had, but I want to come back to something, which is, you know, in the bigger picture of agriculture, if we look at, you know, the corn, soy, and cotton acreage, well, let me put it this way. Vegetable acreage, vegetables produced for human consumption in the United States is about 4 million acres total. United States, it's a lot of land, 4 million acres.
Mm-hmm.
Corn, soy, and cotton combined are 160 million acres.
Wow.
Right? So in terms of land management and those types of things, vegetables are a rounding error.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we often say, well, we should get people to stop growing corn and soy and start growing fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. Well, if we did that, if we moved even 1 or 2% of corn and soy acreage into fruits and vegetables, you'd double production and crash the market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's not a viable thing. Mm-hmm. But where one of the things that I have come to believe over time, and I've had the same experience that you've had in terms of looking at small scale and urban ag and trying to understand both its viability and its importance, mm-hmm. if we look at it in terms of a large scale economic importance or land management importance, it's very, very, very small. Mm-hmm. But we look at the role of farmers market production, we look at the role of urban ag, when we look at the role of them in terms of connecting people to where their food comes from, mm-hmm. building an understanding of sustainability, building an understanding of what food is, where it comes from, and providing a gateway into a deeper conversation about structure of agriculture, structure of where our food comes from, all of those types of issues, it's critically important. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've come to the point of believing really strongly that that kind of direct connection of people with where their food comes from mm-hmm. is a critical piece of the sustainability puzzle. Mm-hmm. Because it is about power. It is about people's ability to control their food supply very, very directly. It's about understanding and consciousness. Wait a minute, that's what a tomato tastes like? Why mm-hmm. do these tomatoes not taste like that, mm-hmm. right? That's what an apple tastes like? What about this, right? Mm-hmm. You can point to a whole lot of ways that small-scale direct market ag has shifted the conversation mm-hmm. in the broader agricultural community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so part of the challenge is, and I was talking to a friend once when I was about doing Why Farms Fail, that talk. And it's been interesting because it's a popular talk. I do it different places. But I was talking to a friend who does a lot of work around beginning farmers and a lot of work around farmer training and all that kind of other stuff. And they said, you know, I said, I'm doing this Why Farms Fail talk. And they said, oh, you don't want to do that. You don't want to discourage people. We need beginning farmers. Mm-hmm. And that comment struck me so strongly because it was like, we need them to be beginning farmers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, they need, you know, there are important mm-hmm. markets. It wasn't what they need. It wasn't their viability. It was, we want to encourage them to do this thing. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I'm in that story is, and part of what I'm hearing you say is, yeah, a lot of that storytelling and a lot of that other stuff has been about promoting a form of agriculture that we feel good about and that I feel yeah. good about too, I think is important. Mm-hmm. But you're right. We have to have some really hard conversations about what makes that viable or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Part of the challenge that we can't escape though is larger scale production, fruit and vegetable production, livestock production. People go to the farmer's market and they go, wait a minute, your chicken is $6 a pound. I can go to the mm-hmm. grocery store and get it for 99 cents. Mm-hmm. And what they don't recognize is that 99 cent chicken is 99 cents because there's a huge amount of thousands of ways.
Yeah.
That cost is mm-hmm. subsidized by federal programs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's subsidized by all kinds of things.
Yeah, just some of you. And, you know, in my conversation, my interview with Carol Williams, you know, I told her we could do a whole show about the dark side of cheap food, you know.
Oh, man, yeah.
You know, nobody in this country wants people to not be able to afford. Well, there may be some people who don't want people to afford food. But we have to look at that 99 cent a pound chicken and right. really look at all costs, you know, not only the subsidies, but the labor issues, the making somebody stand on the chicken line for
right.
Hours and process X amount of chickens per hour at an ungodly rate. You know, we could do a whole show about that. And I'm looking for somebody who can speak about that. But
here's where I think what you're saying is really important, mm-hmm. which is people get stuff around sustainability. There's much more consciousness of it. There's much mm-hmm. more awareness of it. While farmers markets and small scale direct markets are incredibly important, urban, mm-hmm. urban farms, extremely important for a lot of reasons around awareness and understanding and control and entrepreneurship and all kinds of things. We will not farmers market our way out of this. Mm-hmm. Right. When we right. look at the larger scale impacts, mm-hmm. you take the three legs of the stool, mm-hmm. economic, environmental, social, mm-hmm. environmental impacts, justice impacts, economic impacts, impacts on communities, impacts on individuals. We will not, farmers markets are a critical piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. But to me, the critical piece is that small scale ag is a gateway to a deeper conversation about structure of ag. Because mm-hmm. we don't get at these structural issues, we don't, then that form of agriculture and sustainable agriculture remains a niche mm-hmm. that is relegated to direct markets. and high value markets. Mm-hmm. And you know, we can talk about it, sort of how all that plays out and some of those dynamics. But, you know, one of the things that I hear is people are like, a pox on all their houses. I'm just going to go buy straight from the farmer. And that's my thing. Like, you know, that's great. And that's important. But we will not farmers market our way out of this.
No. And, you know, someone who's been involved in promoting urban ag, you know, I remember sitting in a meeting with some NIFA folks. And the topic of urban ag came up. And everybody said, well, we don't support urban ag. We can't do urban ag because it's not in the regs. And we debated about this. And not only, so we went and looked at the regs that these folks were citing. And not only was urban agriculture not mentioned in the regs, agriculture wasn't mentioned in these regs that they were telling us. And and now we're at a point now where USDA has set up this, is going to set up this agency with for urban ag. And I was telling somebody, a pretty high up person the other day, I was talking to a couple weeks ago, and he was proud of the fact that they had this urban ag initiative, which I'm happy about. Mm-hmm. But they put it under NRCS. And I said, you know, at the National Outreach Conference, when I was sitting on that opening panel, and the guy next to me, I think he was second or third in command at NRCS. I said, man, I remember when you guys practically threw me out the room.
Right.
Started talking about urban ag. But as someone who's been involved in urban ag, my extreme disappointment with urban ag is that I never thought urban ag was going to feed the world, Scott, and it won't. It won't, you know, and it all comes down to land uses policies and the price of that land. And, you know, that's the big obstacle for urban ag. If I could stick a condo, development where I'm going to make millions of dollars, you know, I'm not going to do urban ag there.
Right.
But I saw urban ag as the gateway to connect with some of these smaller and mid-sized farms in the rural areas because they had the window into markets. You know, so for example, in Atlanta here, you know, you have a lot of diverse people moving in. You have people from the Caribbean, you have people from Africa, you got folks moving from up north down here who have disposable income, and they're looking for the foods of their homelands. And it just disappoints me, Scott, that connection still, we still have this divide there, you know? Because I know farmers in South Georgia who got a couple of hundred acres, you know? I know one farmer's growing 5-6 acres of collard greens and stuff like that. And, you know, if you get behind them and tell that story, people will buy their crops, but that just doesn't seem to be happening, so. It's very disappointing to me.
And part of the challenge, as you're talking about, the part of the challenge of the story, and marketing and connections based on story has been incredibly important, and it always will be, and all those types of other things. But part of the challenge is we are where we are because our federal policy and our choices framed out the agriculture that we wanted to create back in the 30s. And there was an underlying frame, which was to facilitate the efficiencies of an industrial system superimposed on a natural system by being able to to externalize cost and risk, right? I mean, that's, you're facilitating efficiencies. Mm-hmm. Part of the challenge that we have is, you know, and you know so well, one of the concepts of sustainability have two parts. One is the three-legged stool, but the other part is a systems approach. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges that I have working in federal policy and working in credit issues and all those kind of other things is we often take what is essentially an input-based approach. We don't have enough beginning farmers. Let's create something that creates beginning farmers, right? Not the systems approach that says, wait a minute, why are beginning farmers having such a hard time getting in? Mm-hmm. Why is it? And I was just working on this morning. Two farms next to each other, one that it's 2,000 acres of corn and soy, the other of which is an integrated livestock, row crops, vegetables, rotational grazing, but selling into a diversity of markets and to selling a diversity of crops. Now, if we look at those from the outside in terms of risk, it's really clear which one of those is riskier and which one is not. The one that's far more diversified, that's a far less, that's addressing risk within the production system. Mm-hmm. Corn and soy, you got 100% of your income in the field during the time when you're most likely to either get droughts in the latter part of the summer or hurricanes in August, September, October. Right? You got 100% of your income in the field if you're a corn, soy, cotton operation, right? If I'm a diversified fruit and vegetable, like some of the vegetable growers I talk to, they're like, yeah, by the time I get to hurricane season, I've already got 75% of my income in the bank because I've been selling since March, right? The risk differences are really clear. But if those two farmers, the large-scale commodity farmer versus the highly integrated farm, walk into the bank and try to get a loan, guess which one's going to get a loan faster?
The commodity farmer's going to get a loan.
The other one, if they get a loan, it's going to be heavily collateralized on their real estate. It's going to be a really different. It's going to be a very different loan situation. That has a huge amount to do with why we are where we are. Right. That fact is a function of federal policy. That fact that one can get a loan and investment and the other cannot or can't get it on the same terms is a function of federal policy. It's a function of the system that we've created, and it drives all of the issues that we're talking about. And this is one of the points that I, in terms of activists and people working on this, I constantly go to things and people say, the system is broken. And my response is, no, it's not. The system is not broken. The system is doing exactly what it was designed to do. All of the things that we interact with, the loss of small and mid-scale farms, the loss of black farmland and the, and the farmland owned by farmers of color, the specialization of farms, the concentration of ownership of farmland, the transition of the, and we haven't even touched on the transition of ownership of farmland from the farmer to a private investment firms, right? The increased switch of farmland to invest to an investment vehicle rather than being owned by the farmer. That's huge. It's a giant issue. All of those things, you know, the separation of people from where their food comes from, the, you know, all of these things in the parlance of computers, it's not a bug. It's a feature. Right. It's the point. It's not right. Facilitating the efficiency of specialized and concentrated systems is the point of the exercise. As long as we don't address that underlying frame, as long as we don't address that, all of our work on sustainable agriculture is going to be swimming upstream. We're going to be fighting the system. And we're going to be doing it on an input basis, which is a violation of the very concepts of sustainability that we work with. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes. And to that point, Scott, you know, people at this point may be depressed to listen to it, but, you know, do you think there's hope? Do you think there's hope for the work that you and I do, that we can at least increase and support the farmers who farm sustainably, or are we just Sisyphus pushing a rock uphill only to have it roll down the hill at the end of the day? So.
Well, this is, I was out doing field work with some farms with a young person who was an intern with us. And this is a long time ago. And we were talking about these issues and talking about all this stuff. And at the end of the day, they looked at me and they said, when do we win? And the first answer to that was and what came into my head was, we don't. The issues that we're dealing with are dynamics. These are balances of power. And those dynamics move back and forth. They are themselves dynamic. They're not set. They're not fixed. So there will always be forces towards concentration. There will always be people pushing back towards community-based, grassroots-based. There will always be these dynamics. And so we have to look at it in terms of not a dialectic, you know, it's us versus them and one of us wins, but in terms of finding the balance. You know, economies of scale are real, but so is resilience. Finding this balance between efficiency and resilience is going to be a constant dynamic that we're going to fight and have to push on forever. And we always have, and we always will.
Yeah. I still think this whole, I was talking to
someone
last night, and I said, one of the things I want to concentrate my work on going in 2020 is whenever you hear the term new and beginning farmers, you never hear age mentions in it. You know, that, you know, on the outskirts you hear age, but new and beginning, less than 10 years is generally what you hear. But we really need to start concentrating on people, say 35 and under, to really start grooming these folks in more sustainable ways of agriculture and supporting them, putting some backing for them. Because I've been in, when I got involved with New and Beginning Farmers, I was 45 years old. And that's not old. But, you know, I've seen New and Beginning Farmer programs where the farmers coming into the programs and getting trained were 50 and 60. And yeah. I don't have anything against that, but we really need to get a younger cadre of folks in this who, especially if they're passionate about it, you know? And so I think there's hope. There's a lot of younger folks now whose their core beliefs involve sustainability. They believe in climate change, and you know it's just not, USDA is not going to do that, but I think it's up to organizations like yours, like Rafi and us, to really get behind, identify those folks and really support them. So before I leave you, I would be remiss if we didn't talk about the work that you're doing around farmer stressors and farmer mental health. So I know you're doing a bunch of stuff around that, but I want to talk, and I didn't, as someone who's been involved in this work, Scott, I sort of knew it was an issue, but there was a couple of things that really dropped an anvil on my head. It was, one was after Hurricane Michael, I was sitting down having my breakfast and watching TV, and they were talking about the coverage of Hurricane Michael, and it just dawned on me. I said, holy shit. You know, we had a hurricane up in, I don't remember her name, but up in North Carolina. And I was talking with folks at North Carolina A&T about it. And then we had the storms in Texas and Louisiana. And I said, man, the Southeast is getting killed. Yep. And I was looking at it for the perspective of, well, no farmer likes to talk about their feelings. You know, you and I have talked about this. If you give a seminar on farmer suicide, the room's going to be empty. So, yeah. But I said, you know, no farmer likes to talk about it. And in the Black community, mental health issues are not really discussed. You know, we're starting to have a full awareness, but it's not discussed or swept under the rug. And I was like, man, I wonder how many farmers out there are suffering. And then my mom passed away back in February. And between November and December, I was driving up to, you know, just to be with my sister and stuff while she was going what she was going through. And so I stay with my, I break the trip up two legs and stay with my brother-in-law in Suffolk, which is on the Eastern Shore. And then you take 13 up into Jersey. And I passed a suicide hotline billboard. Yep. Now you see those a lot on highways, but what struck me, it was specifically aimed at farmers.
Yep.
They had a picture of a farmer sitting at a table and just call, and then coming back a sort of same thing. And I said, well, there's this issue, and you've been working through your work with FarmAid, you've been working on this issue for many, many years. I just want to end this segment just talking about, one, just what you saw in the past, and B, what's going on right now. And is it any different, or do you think it's worse, or, you know, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned right now.
There are. And this is where I would start, which is, if you think about the things, the identity that we think of when we think of farmers, independent, self-directed, stand on their own 2 feet, pull themselves up by their bootstraps, work hard, care for the land, all of those things. The things that make farmers the respected, the people that are very highly respected in lots of ways. When you combine that and that expectation that I'm going to stand on my own 2 feet and my own hard work and all that kind of things, and you combine that with an economic system that says, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you're not going to be successful. Mm. right? Because of economies of scale, because of concentration of, you know, corporate concentration, concentration of markets, all those other things. Increasingly, farmers are under, because of things completely out of their control, and natural disasters is part of it, and the whole issue of climate change and all the natural disasters. But you throw in their markets, you have, you know, instead of 10 different poultry integrators, you have two, which means that they've got you over a barrel. Mm-hmm. The high level of debt that you're carrying much higher levels of debt than you used to have to for all this technology means that you're carrying, you know, I was knowing farmers who were investing $1 million operating capital to take home 30,000. That's crazy.
Yeah. Right?
But all of those things mean that farmers will go away. All of those things about caring for the land, standing on your own 2 feet, who you are, their investment as a farmer means that they're going to go much further sticking with it than somebody who doesn't have that kind of personal investment. And the industry knows that. And they're able to drive people and profit from it. So the point is, when you get this combination of the expectation of individual responsibility and autonomy and hard work, and that being rewarded and that being your role, when you combine that with an economic system that says, it doesn't matter how hard you work, we're going to take that away from you. Mm-hmm. When you put those two things together, that's going to create a great deal of frustration and stress and all kinds of other things. And that stress is going to go one of two directions. It's going to go either going to go in, which is depression, suicide, substance abuse, or it's going to go out, which is domestic violence and other acts of acting out. Mm-hmm. And other acts of violence. It's going to go one direction or the other.
I didn't even think about that. You know, you always think about the inward stuff, but you never think about people taking that, those frustrations and turning it outwards. You know, that's an interesting perspective.
The rise of radicalization came straight out of, the rise of the militia movements came straight out of the 80s farm crisis. Mm-hmm. It's a huge point of radicalization. Mm-hmm. Again, this is part of the design. Mm-hmm. If you have a system that is designed to concentrate, to have a go after economies of scale and specialization, what that means is that people are going to lose. Mm-hmm. Right? No one's out making more farmland, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're predicated around increasing the scale of farms, somebody's going out, and they're going out all the time. Mm-hmm. And part of it is what we see and what we deal with is the human cost of the industrialization process. Mm-hmm. This is not just like, and it bothers me when people talk about it in terms of a biomedical model. You need to get medication. You need to get counseling. No, this stress and you know, depression and stress and all that kind of things is a logical response to an illogical system. Mm-hmm. Right? This is not an illogical response. Mm-hmm. It is based on very real dynamics and very real powerlessness. It's not just feelings of powerlessness. It is powerlessness, mm-hmm. right? Things are out of your control. Mm-hmm. One of the things, and so in terms of this, and you are absolutely right, that what you brought up at the very beginning, that focus on the Midwest, large-scale white farmers in the Midwest, an astronomical percentage of the materials on mental health are focused on white male large-scale farmers in the Midwest. Mm. An astronomical percent, because even some of the southern universities pick up the research that comes from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And there was really good work done in the Midwest in the 80s farm crisis, mm-hmm. around these mental health impacts. Mm-hmm. But we have really not done the work to look at how these issues play out differently in communities of color, in smaller scale communities, in different areas of the country, and in mm-hmm. different places. And to recognize that this is playing out, there are moments where the numbers get over, there are moments when there's more of a critical mass, but that's the speed and the numbers, not the absence or presence. We've never had a time. I mean, I'm not an expert on mental health stuff. Mm-hmm. I only know it because we deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was the person who was answering phone calls, I had to have suicide prevention training. Mm-hmm. And a series of our staff people have to go through that suicide prevention training because we've dealt with it and we've had those calls. We're going to have more of them. And I think we're going to have more of them soon. Mm-hmm. And so those of us who work in agriculture have to be way more aggressive of meeting people who are going through this transition. See, and I'll finish with this because I think it's really important. There is a mental model in farming that huge amounts of resources have been put behind, which allows farmers who are above the line of viability to distance themselves from those who are below the line of viability. Yeah. If I'm still farming, I'm different from those who went out. And they went out because they're bad managers, or they went out because they're lazy, they went out because of this or that or that or that or that. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that it's been heavily driven by concentration, and a lot of these, you know, policy and market and other issues have really driven a lot of that loss, mm-hmm. right? But there's this cognitive thing that is like, I'm this, they're that, I'm not them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to say that, because when those farmers who are above the line, when they start to have issues, you know, they've already ingrained this mentality into their head that the farmers below the line, they did something wrong. They were less.
Right. It's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
They're not
and
worthy.
So when
they're
they start to have problems,
right.
No, it's like, oh, wait a minute, you know.
Right.
You know, they probably get even more depressed because they're not supposed to be like those folks who are below.
Exactly right. And so what happens is when they fall below the line, the problem is they have nowhere to land because mm-hmm. they've already distanced themselves from the people who share their experience. Mm-hmm. And they're no longer a part of the people that they identify with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're on their own. Yeah. And there's an unfortunate, well, not a, I'm going to, it's more than unfortunate. There's a really nasty dynamic to that, mm-hmm. which is around issues of discrimination and other things, which is, well, when you went through it, that was right and good. You deserve to lose your farm. I don't deserve to lose mine. Mm-hmm. When I go through it, it's an injustice. When you went through it, that was fine. That wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. To me, one of the core questions, one of the core issues in dealing with these issues over the next few years, and I'm not talking a long time from now, I'm talking about a couple of months from now, mm-hmm. is when farmers go through that experience, who is present to help them see their connection to the people who went through it before, mm-hmm. and not their distance from the people who went through it before? Mm-hmm. Who is there to help them make sense of the world and why they've gone through this, and how to focus their energy in a positive rather than a negative way. And that question, I think, is going to be key. It's going to be key in lots and lots of ways. Because if we don't address it, I can say that there are lots of messages that take that down a really bad path. And that bad path can either be internal or it can be external. Mm-hmm. And so being able to find these connections of those with those who went before it, and that's across lines of scale, that's across lines of race, it's across lines of gender, it's across lines of a whole series of things, being able to find that connection and find a place of going, oh, I get it, I'm not in it alone. The biggest message that we put out, that we have to consistently put out for farmers who are going through that crisis, is you are not alone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are not the only one. You are connected to other people who've been through it too. Your experience is connected to a lot of other folks. Mm-hmm. It's a part of a bigger dynamic, and you are not alone. Mm-hmm. And that connecting people is a really critical piece of this puzzle.
Okay. Okay. Well, Scott, I want to thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, happy to.
Looking forward to catching up with you at Southern Sog.
Absolutely.
Does Rafi have any events coming up that you want to announce or publicize? Or?
We're a little ways off from doing our Come to the Table conference. We do a conference every other year. It's not this spring, but the following spring is going to be our Come to the Table conference, which is a food, faith, and farms conference, mm-hmm. bringing those groups together to address more mm-hmm. systemic issues and really look mm-hmm. at drivers of both farm issues, but also food security and food access, things like that. So that'll be in North Carolina in a year. We continue to have our work on, we're continuing to have our work, our farm crisis hotline. We're taking calls. We also are doing a series of things. At some point, we should talk about we should do one of these and talk about the whole question of disasters and climate change.
Yes.
And disaster recovery. Because yes. we're doing some, mm-hmm. doing pretty extensive work in Eastern North Carolina around disaster recovery. Mm-hmm. But really, what does community-based disaster recovery look like? Mm-hmm. So we're part of some groups who are doing some work in Eastern North Carolina on those issues.
Are you
so,
working
with a lot of this stuff?
A&T at all?
A little bit.
Okay.
They're
okay.
part of some of it. And we've had some conversations with them.
Dr. Ely and there's a whole 1890. And once again, these are the bright spots you see, but the 1890 land grants have formed a consortium that's working on these issues. And looking to develop culturally appropriate practices to addressing this disaster recovery work. But that's something that really needs to be done, and I commend you for doing it. And whatever we can do to help you spread the word, you just let us know. But thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for giving us this interview, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in Little Rock, guy.
Absolutely. You too. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.